Welcome to Two Teas in a Pod. I'm Kate Diaz, a Manchester math teacher and elected president of CEA, the Connecticut Education Association. We are Connecticut's largest teachers union, representing tens of thousands of professional educators across the state.
And I'm Jocelyn Delancey, a fifth grade teacher in Darien, elected vice president of CEA and president of CEF, the Connecticut Education Foundation, CEA's charitable arm.
In every episode, you'll hear thought-provoking interviews, as well as actionable tips and strategies that you can implement in your daily life. We'll have stimulating discussions to help you become a more informed, an effective educator, and advocate for your students and the teaching profession.
Thanks for spending some time with us today. Now let's jump right into Two Teas in a Pod.
Well, Jocelyn, today we are very lucky. We have a twofold superstar set with us. We have our members and legislator friends, Chris Poulos and Kevin Brown, who are also Teacher of the Year individuals. So we are very proud to have a multi-tiered level of infamy.
Chris is Teacher of the Year.
Yeah, I appreciate the promotion, Kate.
Sorry.
I'm not that good, but my good colleague Chris here is, so.
Well, I think you should be. Have you put in for it yet?
I finished second in my own building once. That's about as close as I ever came.
So. Well, full disclosure, me too. I came in second to my good friend Kathy. Yep. Yeah. We wrote each other their letters of recommendation, just so you know.
My school district doesn't participate in Teacher of the Year, so I've been excluded permanently.
Or you've always been in your heart
it that way. We absolutely can.
Well, anyway, we are happy to have them here today. Gentlemen, we are so appreciative of your work today and every day with the legislature. It is incredibly affirming to have you in those seats, to know that we have teachers, to know that we have people fighting the good fight on our behalf, and knowing also, by the way, that we have people we can call who will always answer our calls. So we are really thrilled to have you across the street in the legislature here with us today, members, as colleagues. This is a really wonderful, wonderful experience for us. And so welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. It's great to be here.
So legislative session, really just getting underway. What are the things that you are excited about in the session, other than it eventually being over?
Well, you nailed it. I think you're right. We're just counting down until May 8th. It's a short session this year, which is nice. Of course, the first year of a legislative term is a long session and goes January to June. This one is February to May. But there's a lot going on, a lot of moving parts, lots of committees. We all serve on multiple committees that have lots of bills going forward and lots of debate and discussion, public hearings on them. So it's good to participate in the process, and it's good to be able to be there and to hear what the public has to say about these things. But certainly, Chris and I both serve on education, and there's a lot of exciting things that we part of last year and are looking to be part of going forward.
Yeah, I think, Kevin, when you talked about the process, that's what excites me the most. And there's a number of initiatives that I have been involved with from past session and even over the summer, where people have come forward with ideas, they have become concepts, and now these concepts are being heard in public hearings. And it's great to call up constituents or call up teachers and invite them and say, I'd really like you to come and testify in favor of your idea. And so it's a great process, and I learn the most from a public hearing. I form my opinions after going to those meetings and obviously talking with colleagues like Kevin. We often hang out after a meeting's over just to kind of debrief and process and evolve in our thinking about what we have to do.
Yeah. So we have a number of educators that we kind of promote and ask to testify. I know for some members, it's a little scary or intimidating, or they might not necessarily understand the process. Can you share a little bit with us about the impact that it might have on you when somebody comes across the street or zooms over through their computer screen? What's the impact that might have for you? Have you had a moment where you heard somebody that just really compelled you to change your mind or think about something differently?
Absolutely. It's the most important part of the process, as Chris alluded to, right? It's hearing from the public, hearing from people who these policies and these laws that we enact, how it affects them, or the lack thereof, right? If there isn't a policy in place and how people are being affected by it. So to hear from people's firsthand perspective on what is happening with whatever given situation it may be, that's like the most powerful and compelling testimony that we can get is to hear from the people and what's happening in their lives. And particularly as an educator, it's always nice to see A, other educators, but B, also students. When we see young people engaging in the process and having their voices heard for the first time, many times for the first time, getting involved in the process, it's the most powerful. And I've always told that to my students, you know, in my years, 18 years as a civics teacher, that's what I've aimed to do, is to get young people involved in the process. So seeing it firsthand up here is, you know, it makes me feel good about the work that we do when young people especially are getting involved in the process.
Yeah, one of the reasons why I got involved in government early in my career, I observed a gap between policy and practice. So I would turn on the TV or read an article or hear that someone was proposing an idea, but they weren't involving teachers. And I think I started teaching in 2000, and shortly thereafter, No Child Left Behind was authorized by the federal government. Not one single teacher was involved in that, in crafting that legislation, and it was a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And it took over a decade to get rid of it. And so when you're at a hearing and you hear an active classroom practitioner or a kid that is going to a class and learning and they're talking about their experience, it really serves, I believe, to close that gap between the people making the decisions and what's actually happening in the classrooms. And to defend myself and Kevin and all the other members of the legislature, we're good-intentioned people. We don't go to the Capitol saying,
"Agreed,
we're going to do some bad things to people today." We're really trying to solve problems. But if it's a transportation bill, and I haven't been to my local public works department or to the Department of Transportation, I may not understand fully the implications of a decision that I'm making on what's actually happening on Connecticut's highways and roads. And so those hearings and those testimonies really provide, I think, the most important context to help us make the best decisions.
Well, I think that you hit the nail on the head, you know, and when we talk to people about come and tell your story, talk about what you know, we don't ever need you to go beyond what you actually know, because the context for these decisions is so critical. You know, I think about the number of things that we as teachers kind of are confronted with in terms of, you know, mandates or things that we have to kind of manage. You know, thinking about standardized testing alone, right? People think that it's an accountability metric, right? Like this real clear, you know, we'll know what kids are doing. We'll know what teachers are doing based on this test, because there's a simplicity to that, right? Like it kind of sanitizes the learning process, if you will. But they don't understand what we know to be true, which is that when you're doing that level of assessment and constant assessment of kids, you are impacting their confidence. You're impacting their longevity, their capacity as a learner, their willingness to be persistent. There's so much more. And you're not actually gleaning the insight you think you're gleaning. And it's not that there's not a place for assessment. I think all of us understand as benchmark data, you know, there are points in time we want to understand. We want to understand the trajectory of student learning. But we over-assess to make a lot of outside forces feel better. And in the end, all of that assessment, you know, you talk about No Child Left Behind and Common Core, right? All of these things haven't actually moved anything. All they've done is suck the joy out of teaching. And, you know, so I think it is so critical. And I'm glad to hear that, you know, when we are really trying to rally the troops and get them to speak, that what they say is really, you know, helps in making those decisions. Because I think sometimes you feel like you're, you know, screaming into the abyss. So knowing that directing our energy, you know, at these hearings and at these our lobby days and legislative breakfasts are really, truly well-deserved opportunities to speak and put into context the legislation.
I think the same could be said about teacher evaluation.
Oh, yes.
And I mean, when I look back to the last legislative session, that was probably the most significant impact, I think, we made on the teaching profession. The ECS funding is great, but for actual impact on a classroom teacher, I can tell you as a member of a PDEC committee, as someone who was involved in the crafting of our evaluation plan back 10 years ago, that those changes that we passed last session have significantly positively impacted how I'm evaluated and what I'm learning at school. And so I remember a couple of these public hearing sessions where people would come to testify, not teachers and not students,
but right,
experts from organizations.
Experts is a very generous term.
And they would say, well, we need to assign a number to a teacher. And I would look at them and say, look, first of all, I wrote a sub plan to be here today. And second of all, I get those numbers every year and they don't help me. And, you know, I think people were listening. And I think collectively, when teachers can get that message out and, you know, it really makes a difference.
Well, I think, too, the impact, right, of some of these legislations that have been passed, you know, over a decade ago. Really, it's kind of crazy to think that it was that long ago. But, you know, we're going to live through that impact for a while. It's going to take some time to get out of the practice of, well, I need to rate my teacher because what if they're bad and how do I get them out if they're bad? Kind of.
What if your accountant's bad?
Right. I mean,
you don't put rate them a 2 and then, like, what does it mean? Right. Like, at some point there's the practical, which I always chuckle when we start. And I agree with you. The collective consciousness has got to shift. But I'm excited about the work that you did.
And I think what it means is, like, now we can actually have goals that allow for us to grow, shine, get excited, be inspired, collaborate, and think differently about how we help our students. And the best part about it is you're not just going to get a number and call it a day. You're actually going to have a conversation with your evaluator to say, this is something I'd really like some support or growth in. And here are some supportive measures I'd like to have. Here's a conference I'd like to go to. Here's a program I'd like to access, you know, and really work. Or here's some time I'd like to have to collaborate with my colleague. You know, really meaningful work that actually shifts. Not just I want PD and, you know, a program that I can actually just read the teacher manual, by the way. And if I've passed all of those ridiculous, exceptional, standardized tests to get to where I am, I should be able to handle that.
So. You'd be able to read. I think you have an opportunity this session, and I'm hopeful to have a similar impact with the legislation that we've worked with DCF on mandated reporter reform. I think that that has the potential to significantly impact how we are able to engage with our families, the way that the professionalism it returns and restores by allowing for good faith. And at least like the base level of inquiry around a situation, because we've been really deprofessionalized in that process in the last, you know, 10, well, probably really 6 years. And I think to see that be able to be pivoted, we can restore the good faith, we can restore the professional practice. It allows us to hopefully work with families more generously, you know, to give ourselves a little space to do good work. I mean, I'm excited for that legislation to be heard. I'm excited that it was a compilation of our work with the superintendents, with DCF, with parent influence. You know, so there's a lot of exciting framework around that. I'm sure somebody, an expert, will come out of the woodwork to tell us that it's wrong, but I'm excited about the possibility because I think it has the potential to be just as impactful.
The nice thing, and I want to bring it back to Chris's point about the well-intentioned things that go on in the legislature, is that most people there are there for the right reasons, but they rely on numbers, right? If things are numbers driven. I need something to easily quantify like how things are going. And if you come from outside the education world, you don't necessarily understand that not everything is measured in a number, that it's a far more nuanced profession because you're dealing with humans, you're dealing with people, and people are not simplistic in a number form. You need to be able to assess across multiple things. And that gets to the point of allowing teachers to have that professionalism to make that determination. Not that we're trying to make kids less safe, because I truly believe that teachers in their professionalism would make the right call when they see these things happening. But you have to allow them to do that, to just, you know, have it scripted that every single thing gets called in, if for nothing else, bogs the system down in the system.
100%. And it has bogged the system down. And 94% of the things we've called in have been dismissed. And it's not so much that we ultimately, if we're doing our job right, we should have probably a substantiation rate that's closer to 70-80%, which is a terrifying sounding number. But I'd rather get 70-80% of a smaller number and get that right than to sit here and say, well, we called in, you know, hundreds and hundreds of things and 94% of them were dismissed.
Now, those are numbers that make much more sense.
Exactly.
Well, and because the impact of calling those in when they're not real or they're something that could have been resolved otherwise, that impact is truly tremendous as well. We have teachers out of classrooms. subs in covering and just the impact that something like that can have on an educator and their morale and their ability to kind of stay engaged and motivated in the work can also have an impact if it's the wrong call. That's really a detrimental part of that process. And again, like you said, the time that we're losing to really pay attention to the cases that matter and that should be looked into and have that level of care and kind of eyes on it.
Yeah. Although I want to go back to something you said, Chris, because I think it's really critical that the ECS money is super hard for us to get excited about. It's one where everybody high-fives each other. But the practical piece of that is it doesn't necessarily translate to the teachers, that it often ends up as diverted funds and it ends up, being supplanted in different ways because there's really not a direction with those additional funds. So, but I will say we have been playing with the idea of how does some of those funds get directed where we need them to go, which is to things like starting salaries. Just to put a clarifier out there, because this always comes up, when we talk about starting salary, increasing it to like a 60,000 number, that would necessitate us to talk about the whole salary schedule. So I don't want there to be confusion, because there are people out there who hear us talk about that and think we are interested in starting people ahead of where current people are. Our mindset, because of how we tackle these issues, would be if we initiated a 60 starting, then we would talk about the whole salary schedule and how everyone would be potentially positively impacted. Potentially we could be looking at restructuring, reducing steps. I mean, there's a lot of upside, but it's about getting the direction of those funds. Have you guys had the opportunity to think or talk about any of that with your colleagues?
I've been part of some conversations with some folks, both in and out of the education committee, about why the importance of that, valuing the profession, and that it's not always about compensation, but that is a piece of it. And when you're considering the level of education and the skills required for the job, that it is underpaid comparatively across other professions. I think there's an understanding, and you hear a lot of times people saying, how much they value teachers and they value education. They understand the important role it even played in their own lives. It's about making sure that we have the funds and that we can get those funds directed to that. The worst part about this job is that there is but one pot of money and there is so much need. And you want, in my heart of hearts, I want to be able to give to everything that needs it. And unfortunately, it's not there. So is making sure that we're being most efficient and effective with the money that we have. And not just because I'm a teacher, but because I value education, I can't think of too many other things that are as important as making sure that the people we're putting in front of our children every day and holding them responsible for making sure that our future generations are educated. Like, what is more important than that? So making sure, I think the will is there. It's about finding the way.
There's two levers you can pull to attract, retain great talent and keep people happy in schools. One is financial compensation. Other is quality of work life.
And both are equally impactful.
Both are equally impactful. And so I think with ECS money, for example, and one of the things I see is that if you give a district a big amount of money, say, hey, we're giving you this extra ECS money, in some cases, a district will just use that to reduce the budget and keep their taxes lowered. And so that really doesn't do much for the teacher compensation or maybe the quality of work life, because maybe that's creating, something in the schools that makes their professional life better. But I do think that, like, with ECS money, there should be guidance. I would hesitate to say we have to mandate how that money's spent, because our 169 towns in our state are all vastly very different. So Southington is not going to use the money the same way maybe New Haven.
Right.
And so I think the nice part about guidance is to say you should be using some of this money for compensation or for whatever your district deems is going to help the line with attracting people to the profession and keeping them there from a financial standpoint. But also they may look at broader uses of that money, improve the overall workplace for teachers. And so that they're happier when they go to work because the work conditions have been improved.
Right. That, I have class sizes down. I'm telling you.
That might be one right
there.
That
would be, if, when I think about what makes a difference, right? Like, you know, there's a lot of things that make a difference, but nothing as impactful as an appropriate class size.
Or like meaningfully embedded professional learning.
Well, you are a dreamer, Chris Poulos.
So, but those are things that districts can invest in.
Sure.
That are going to, at the end of the day, they're going to improve the overall outcomes for kids because teachers are learning more. They're happier. They're working longer hours. They're collaborating. It's going down into the classroom.
So I've sat through a couple of Board of Ed meetings in some districts that I have to say have means, right? These are not distressed municipalities in any capacity. And some are larger urban districts and some
with
are
very low mill rates.
Low mill rates. And the frustrating thing that I see is that there's this kind of idea with boards of finance or mayors or city selectmen and boards of ed that districts seem to feel like this educating our students is a liability more than it is an asset, right? We have to keep the percentage down and we have to make sure, like, how can we be efficient? And, you know, my kind of thing is, well, we can be efficient, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's effective. And I can't think of a greater investment than our public education systems in any town. You know, I sat through a Board of Ed meeting last night where they were voting to put out library and media specialists, reading coaches and assistant principals and all sorts of things, like $4 million worth of
humans
that would be student facing resources for these kids, and saying they were staying status quo, which is like, no, you're actually taking the,
right.
You know, your money staying status quo, maybe, but your actual resources and support. But, you know, they're talking about all of these things from the state in terms of, well, we don't know what our ECS dollars will be. And I don't know how we do this at a statewide level, but I think the state has to set the tone and tenor for how we value public education. And I do think that there are some spaces where the state says that they want, you know, they want teacher recruitment and retention. And we saw a lot of positive changes for workplace last year. But and we saw ECS dollars go up. Although now we're seeing them kind of take that back a little bit from the governor's office. But, you know, we didn't see that kind of common thread of really that this is an investment. We didn't see a commitment to salary last year. We did not see actualization of the COVID credit of any sort to say, like, we really value the fact that we stayed. We were one of the few states that actually had a lot of schools in person throughout the whole 2020-21 school year.
An accomplishment that launched Miguel Cardona to the national level, I might add.
Correct. You know, so we didn't see those. And I'm just curious from your standpoint and your thought process, like, how do we really show, like, this state of Connecticut, our state legislature, our governor, you know, we are pioneers in public education and really show that we invest in this from what we say to our actions and even the legislation that we pass.
No, that's an excellent point. And I think what we need to do in order to do that is to kind of borrow a term from the business world that many people in the legislature understand, is this idea of a return on investment and what that actually means in education, because it's not the same as in business. The return on investment in education isn't something that you're necessarily going to see right away. It's not going to be on a budget sheet. It's going to be in how is your community doing? Is it thriving? Are people staying there? Are kids getting educated, coming back, opening businesses, getting involved, whether it's politically or in other civic organizations. And that's really what your return is when you're talking about an investment in education. So if your community is thriving in that way, then the education system there is working. Forget about whatever the numbers, test scores, things said. It's how is your community doing? And if it's thriving, that's the return that we're looking for. So we sometimes get caught up in those numbers, like we said before, but you have to look at return on investment in terms of education, and it's a little bit different than just a bottom line dollar number.
But it is doable, and I like how you're thinking on that, because, you know, we've been really kind of banging the drum of we are not a liability, we are an asset. We are the basis of your local economy, your state economy. You don't have anything if your education systems are crumbling. You don't have any place to draw new people to. You have no way to incentivize businesses to come here because you're not viewed as a stable environment. It's the basis of all the workforce needs. So I like the way that you're kind of thinking about what does an ROI actually look like, because it is a universally understood concept. But you're correct that our benchmarks on that, how do we frame an ROI, has to be a little more nuanced in terms of, but listen, real estate agents have been doing this for years, right? They've quantified and they'll tell you where the good schools and the bad, right? Like there's a process here that is somewhat embedded in our systems. And so, you know, it's about how do we turn that and make it a more broadly understood and a translation that people can really kind of absorb.
Well, and I would say this, though, because we do have school systems that are doing really well and still trying to look at ways that they can shortchange their budgets. So I think about it like I think about Kansas City, right? They're not looking at their team this year and saying, well, how do we spend just as much money on next year's team as we did this year's team?
Are you talking about your friends in Darien?
I mean, not necessarily. This is a universal problem. I would say that this is not.
No, it is 100%.
You know, solo to one specific district, right? But when we're looking at return of investment and we're thinking about what that means, you know, looking at your budgets by, well, we only want to, you know, increase it by
flatlining education is bad.
Well, and I also think, and I heard this at the Stratford Board of Ed meeting the other night, and it was the local president who said, you know, give us a visionary budget. Give us a visionary budget, something that will make us look at our school district and see it thriving and being excellent. If the town can't pay for that visionary budget, I think that's when we start having the conversations of how do we use the ECS dollars? How do we use our state funding and support? But the towns should be investing.
I like the idea of visionary.
You know, and I will give Mike credit for that because he really, Michael Fiorello, really did throw that out there. I was like, wow, that's how we should be looking at it. That's what superintendents should be able to do. And I'm hoping as you go into this session and you're speaking for education, that that's the mindset that we want to put through to our stakeholders, right? That this is the world that we want to live in with public education. And we have, you know, I think I can't thank you enough. I can't think that you're doing the session, going to the Capitol, doing all of that work and making sure that your students are being taken care of on a daily basis. That to me is just, we can't thank you enough.
Yeah,
having
absolutely
our educators in office who can still be teaching, who know what it's like every day. You know, you were able to go to that legislative breakfast on Saturday, but the stories you hear are not any different than the ones you live. And I think that's so tremendously important.
Thank you guys so much. And, you know, as you enter sort of the session here and you get into debate, that's around the corner. I think you won't start with that until probably April, really. The way hearings seem to be rolling out. You know, I hope that this concept of visionary budgeting and imagining the possibilities is something that we can work to support you on. One of the things we never want you to ever think is that you're alone, because there's nothing worse than being in those hearing rooms and thinking, am I the only one? So we will commit to making sure you will never be the only one.
And is there anything you want to leave our members with as you head off across the street back to your hearings that you're probably still in the middle of?
I'll just say kind of a concluding thought. And I love the idea of an investment in community and the business analogy of the return on investment. But for the members, I didn't realize until I got to the Capitol and was working with the CEA leadership how much of an asset the CEA is to teachers in our state. And people should really know and appreciate every single thing that this organization does to make our profession a great profession and to help kids and teachers do as much as they can with the resources they have to advance teaching and learning.
And I would just want to echo Chris's sentiments there of how hard CEA and your leadership works to make sure that the teaching profession is valued in the state of Connecticut, and your tireless advocacy across the street is much appreciated. And the last thing I would just leave the listeners with is to understand that your role in the democratic process is you do have access. I think it's real easy for us to lose sight of that and to get frustrated and give up on the system. But don't lose hope. You know, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, as they say. It may not happen the first time you try, but the more that you stand up and use your voice, eventually change starts to happen. And so to keep up with the process, teachers, students, whoever it is out there, participate, you know, and use your voice because it does have an effect.
Absolutely.
So you're going to see a bunch of people testifying in the next couple of weeks, all CEA members.
Please do. Bring it on.
We want to thank all of our members for all you do and for listening to the latest edition of Two Teas in a Pod.
For more education talk, subscribe to Two Teas in a Pod and find us at cea.org/podcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Like what you heard? Share a podcast with your friends and colleagues and spread the word, because we are
stronger together.